Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that doesn't need any umpires. We'll play ball no matter what, Jordan.
It's easier this way, honestly. No one just hovering around us trying to indicate exactly what the rules and regulations are of this podcast. I feel so free, so liberated to be recording this podcast umpireless with you.
Become ungovernable, Jordan.
I mean, this is the way to do it. This is the way to do it. I think your favorite team proved that earlier this week. Of course, we're going to talk about the umpireless game later on. But first, the first half of this show is going to be a bounce around the spring training news and notes. Unfortunately, a lot of it is very huge bummer injury news. So we'll start with three big injuries to contending teams. Truly, then we're going to laugh about Yankees fans a little bit, as we are, you know, as we often do. Then we're going to talk about Andrew Painter, who made his spring debut earlier this week. We're going to talk about the new shift rules and how those are impacting the game, because we did not mention those during our pitch clock check-in earlier this week. And then later on in the show, we have some fun emails we are very excited to get to. And of course, we will talk about the umpireless baseball game. But Jake, we must begin with some bummers, because the truth is, this is kind of the news that we get during spring training. I know it's really extensions or it's terrible injuries that make you very sad. Those are kind of the spring training binary of what is actually happening and what will actually impact the season.
Or how much people weigh.
Sure. Yes. Yes. Those are really the only three options beyond the actual games being played, which, as we all know, only mean so much. So we have three major injuries to get to, and we're going to talk about what they mean for this upcoming season. Let's start with the big one, the biggest injury and the biggest bummer by far, and that is friend of the show, Gavin Lux, tore his ACL running the bases earlier this week and will be out for the year for the Los Angeles Dodgers. This is an enormous bummer because a lot of people really like Gavin Lux as a person, obviously. And as far as the context of his baseball career, this was going to be kind of the year where it's like, all right, Gavin Lux, we let Trey Turner walk because we believe that you finally, once a top five prospect in the game, can be the Dodgers shortstop. They were ready to hand him the keys. And unfortunately, that would not be happening this year. That's the first obvious. I mean, this just sucks. This is just like, every year we have spring training injuries that extremely bum us out, but this one is pretty up there on the bummer scale.
Yeah, the timing of it is the worst part. The Dodgers, a team who year after year spent big money or made big trades or traded prospects away in exchange for all-star elite level players, this offseason, for better or worse, cleared the runway for Lux. Right, they had let Seager go. They let Turner go. They said, Gavin Lux, you're the guy at shortstop. We believe in you. It's go time. And it was go time for about like a week. And then This incredibly unfortunate thing happened.
Well, and to your point, like, again, clearing the runway, and we're gonna obviously have to talk about the next young players who are really going to have to step up now. But Lux had been in the big leagues and had started to show signs of what he was as a prospect, to where no one was really questioning, like, okay, you know, like, this one makes sense. Maybe we don't totally understand, like, diving into giving Miguel Vargas 500 at-bats or some of these, you know, James Outman. But, like, Gavin Lux, people know. People believe in. People want to see succeed at the major league level. That one, you know, sure. And we wanted to see him, like, okay, like, let's see how he does at shortstop. You know, the position he played coming up in the minors and hasn't played that much in the big leagues. And so that part just is extremely unfortunate. Now, at the same time, they did make a move earlier this offseason that makes this slightly less painful, but still very, very challenging, which is that they traded for Miguel Rojas. Now, when they brought in Miguel Rojas, I mean, I think we were wondering, like, maybe they actually do want Miguel Rojas to be the shortstop. They trust him more defensively even before the Lux injury. Now it seems like that will be the clear option, and I guess that is a good insurance policy. Obviously, they did not trade him thinking that Gavin Lux was about to blow his leg out, but that is now the position they sit in, which brings us to the question of, this Dodgers lineup is just not really as badass as it used to be.
Yeah, it's good ass, Jordan, which I guess is a bad thing. Lingo is difficult. Yeah, I mean, you know, you take a look at it, and it's Freddie Freeman and Mookie Betts are, you know, two of the best five, maybe probably five hitters in the world. Is a good start. Max Muncy had a bad first half and a really good second half last year. Will Smith is one of the best catchers in baseball. And then it's a avalanche of question marks. JD Martinez, do they fix him or is he just washed? David Peralta is 35 years old. Trace Thompson had a great 2022, but the 5 years before that was absolutely bupkis. Miguel Vargas is 23 and has not really played it on the big leagues. And Miguel Rojas isn't a hitter. He's a nice guy with a good defensive glove. That's not a team that sounds like they're going to win a division. Maybe Jason Hayward turns the clock back and they unlock some of that. I mean, that's the big Dodgers question mark, right? That's like the final boss of hitting development.
Yeah. Well, which is, and you know, early returns are promising. I mean, to me, what stands out is the age of this lineup. I know this is something we've kind of dunked on the Yankees in recent years, and I think that that is still true to some degree. But man, I mean, you know, Will Smith is really the only guy clearly in his prime at this stage. Of course, Mookie still is, and Freddie Freeman is still awesome. But I'm worried about that bottom half of the lineup in terms of what the drop-off is. I don't think JD Martinez is washed. I mean, he still hit a ton of doubles last year. I think he could still be good. But there's because he is 36, because David Peralta is 36, it's not that these guys weren't that good last year. It's that there's just more looming possibility that they completely fall off a cliff. And Max Muncy, I have no idea what to make of because of how bad he looked at the beginning of last season. I still believe he's going to get on base a bunch. But like that's another one that I'm not as excited about him being my four hitter as I was a few years ago. And then, yeah, that our two friends named Miguel at the bottom of the lineup are just not knowing what we're expecting from him. I know some people are super high on Miguel Vargas, and maybe that will be proven true. And then the bench, you know, we haven't mentioned Chris Taylor yet, but like Yanni Hernandez projecting to be on this bench is not a great sign.
Can I admit something? I had never heard that name before about 6 minutes ago.
Do you know, really, you don't know anything about Yanni Hernandez? Because if you look at Yanni Hernandez, he's basically Alexi Amarista, except even less offense, if that seems possible.
He is
one of the smaller, more stout players that you'll see in the majors and is strictly this is a great example of someone who it's like, oh, he's a switch hitter, but he has a 600 OPS from both sides. It's like, great. That's awesome. He could really get that platoon advantage. But now, I mean,
Jordan, despite all of the skepticism I have about the Dodgers, I'm still going to pick them to win the division because they are the Dodgers.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in our season preview stuff a little bit later. All right, let's move on to our next incredibly unfortunate injury, which is fortunately slightly less unfortunate. Tyler Glasnow, the lip tattooed tree on the Tampa Bay Rays, out for 6 to 8 weeks with a grade 2 oblique strain, or as they call it in Canada, Jordan, a second grade oblique strain.
Second, you lost me. You're going to have to explain that one for everybody here.
In Canada, they don't say first grade or second grade or third grade. They say grade 3, grade 2, grade 8.
Okay. Well, it's confusing because, the medical terminology for these different grades is also confusing every time it gets announced. So I had a lot to process there, but thank you for reminding me how Canadian education works. This one sucks also. Now, fortunately, this one should not take Tyler Glasnow out for much of this season. But I think this one is just disappointing because for the first time since I don't know how long, the conversation at a Rays camp was like, we have like a real adult rotation of starting pitchers. And we are not just going to be, you know, doing our Rays bullshit all the way through the season where we're, you know, calling Lewis Head up and down 5,000 times and we have openers and we have these guys and we really only have two starters. Like with Glasnow back seemingly healthy and with signing of Zach Eflin and with, you know, they extend Jeffrey Springs, they believe in him as a starter. It was looking like they had five real starting pitchers, which I just don't remember the last time you could say that about the Rays. And now it looks like we'll maybe be bounced back into the, you know, the Yanni Chirinos, you know, opening with Garrett Clevenger and Beeks and Sean Armstrong. And, you know, it's and Shane Baz also was the other one. Of course, he had Tommy John at the end of last year that maybe we would have hoped would have factored into this year at some point. But either way, it sucks because Glasnow is one of the most fun pitchers in the league to watch. And as far as projecting this Rays staff and this Rays team, hopefully he's not out for much of the season, but it does still set back any hope that this Rays team can really, really challenge the top of this division, I think.
Oh, I totally agree. And you're right. The idea of five Rays starting pitchers, McClanahan, Rasmussen, Eflin, Springs, Glasnow, was kind of interesting. And now we're going to be forced to sit through like the dominant LGBTQ patch ripper offers coming out of the bullpen,
yep,
which, you know, is both unfortunate and frankly boring. And I would much rather watch Tyler Glasnow than any of those Rays pitchers. Anything else on this, Jordan?
Well, I would just say, like, now I'm a little bit more curious if they push, you know, a Taj Bradley. What is up with Patino? Are we just done with him? Like, I know he's looked really bad, but like that was an arm that I was really excited about that they got in that trade. And he doesn't even seem to project to make the team at this point. Maybe he does now with the Glasnow injury. But yeah, I mean, look, again, the Rays are going to get outs. Like, it's not going to be as pretty as it would have been if Tyler Glasnow was pitching. But, you know, I'm not saying this sinks their season, but it certainly makes me less excited about them because they are in, because the Orioles project to be so much better, because the Jays got better, because the Yankees are as good as they are, because the Red Sox should at least be better than they were a year ago. It's hard to look. I know they're always good, but it's you can see some. You can definitely be a little bit worried about the Rays this year, I think.
If I right, like one of these five teams has to finish last in the AL East, and for the first time in a long time, the Rays are definitely in that mix. I don't think Toronto or New York can finish last, but I think the other three teams can, and I think the Glasnow injury, even if he's back in, you know, 2 months, the Glasnow injury still will play a role. The last injury to talk about is Joe Musgrove, who fractured his toe because he dropped a kettlebell on it while he was lifting. It's his left big toe. So that is his front foot, his plant leg. No, plant leg's your back foot.
Plant leg's your front foot. You tell me, Mr. Pitcher.
But you're, I never understood this. This never sunk in for me because you're planting with both feet.
Right.
I guess it's your plant leg.
That's called gravity.
Plant leg pitching. Here, let's learn about the sport that we are paid to cover. Plant leg pitching. Front leg. So your front leg is apparently your plant leg.
That's what I thought. Yes.
But that doesn't make sense to me because your back leg is planted into the ground.
But what's what I just said? It's gravity. You can't. There's no situation where it's not. One of the legs is going to be planted at some point. That you're. That's unless you're on the moon. I feel like. But it's a good point. It is a little.
They're confused. Both plant legs. It should be front and back. Whatever. His front left toe, I guess, is fractured because he dropped a kettlebell on it. No throwing for 2 weeks, and then he'll, you know, regain strength. It's interesting, right? Because he could, I guess, just sit in a chair and do his throwing routine, but that's not really how it works. I think this makes his opening day start unlikely. If he has only 2 weeks, would mean he has basically two more weeks after that to ramp back up before opening day, and it just doesn't seem like it's going to happen. Jordan, you are an avid weightlifter. What are your takeaways from someone dropping a kettlebell on their toe? Well, have you ever picked up a kettlebell?
Well, I was going to say to you, can you let's back up. You do this to me all the time, and I think it's fair because we want our audience to understand. Jake, what the hell is a kettlebell?
Are you serious?
No, I'm being serious. Like, I think people listening that are not in weight rooms ever are don't know what the hell a kettlebell is. So can you explain what that is?
Do you know what a kettlebell? I'm asking you.
I do. Yes, oh, okay. I do. I'm just saying, like, I'm trying to give you, again, like, okay. There's a lot of things where you ask me, Jordan, what's that? And I'm like, I know what that is, but the people listening might not. No, I understand.
And I was confused whether it was a situation where I'm asking you a question for the sake of the audience or whether you actually didn't know what a kettlebell is.
No, I'm asking for the sake of the audience. Yes.
Well, I'm glad that we've cleared that up. A kettlebell is a weightlifting entity, I guess, that I want you to imagine like a really heavy metal ball
Yeah, I mean, it looks like a bowling ball with a handle. I mean,
it's usually smaller than a bowling ball. I would say it's about the size of like a squishy dodgeball that you would use in class.
But it's hard.
Gym class. But it's hard and incredibly heavy and has a handle. And there's a variety of things you could do with it. I love using kettlebells. I think they're great. I
have you ever dropped one on your toe?
I have never dropped one on my toe. No. And I've also never pitched in the big leagues. So maybe I should drop one on my toe and see if I get called up to the Padres. I would maybe hypothesize, and this is total conjecture, that he wasn't wearing shoes. I mean, depending on the size of a kettlebell, you could break your toe, shoes or no shoes. But Joe Musgrove seems like a no shoes lifting kind of guy.
Based that upon seems like a not kosher thing. That is like a pretty day one thing, is to not lift heavy things with no shoes on. But is that the thing that people do?
Okay. Not at the local Planet Fitness, but it is definitely a thing that people do.
However it happened, he broke his big toe and now he's not going to pitch for a while, even though, as you said, maybe he can just sit down and you know, keep his arm loose. But hey, I mean, this is obvious here. Everyone making fun of the Padres for signing 5,000 starting pitchers. This is why you do that. You never know who's going to drop a kettlebell on their big toe. And now, while obviously I'm much less excited for the Michael Wacha, Nick Martinez, Seth Lugo trio as I would be to watch Joe Musgrove potentially on opening day for the Padres, at least you have some competent pitchers that can step in, and you know, you're not just, you know, dipping into AAA immediately.
I'm kind of surprised we don't get more weight room injuries than we do.
I agree with that. But this one seems like, but I don't know. I can't decide if this one seems extremely plausible or like this never happens to anybody and you have to be a real dummy. I don't know. It's somewhere in between.
It's not like being a real dummy. It's just like a momentary lapse in concentration and then, you know, whiz, bang, boom goes your toe.
But that's the thing. But to your point, this is why it's surprising there are more of them, because these are just heavy things that can hurt you very easily.
They're lifting them every day.
Right. And so that's the thing. It does not take much to end up with a serious ouchie. And yeah, that is what Joe Musgrove now has. And toe injuries are no joke, though. That's like, especially big toe injuries. The difference between a big toe injury and a pinky toe injury, I mean, honestly, like, probably the whole thing. Like, haven't we heard stories of players basically just playing through broken pinky toes like an entire season? Like, that is completely reasonable. But
I would say that your big toe is worth all the other toes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would, if you could give me the four other toes or my big toe, I would take the big toe.
It's big toe for a reason.
Sorry, this has been a message from Big Toe. Big Toe.
Big Toe is really trying to they've been lobbying us hard to make it very clear that it is a big toe for a reason. You cannot live without the big toe. The big toe is very important.
Yeah, there's Big Pharma, Big Dairy, and of course, Big Toe. Let's move on to another baseball juggernaut, the New York Yankees lineup.
Or is it? The New York Yankees lineup last year, outside of record-breaking Aaron Judge, was hardly a juggernaut. They went months at a time doing absolutely nothing besides gawking at what Aaron Judge was doing. And it works until they face the Astros. But coming into this year, a big question, of course, they signed Carlos Rodon in the offseason. That's great. And that's looking awesome. I think Carlos is going to be great. But the offense was not... I would say addressed in really any sort of manner other than bringing Judge back, which is of course a huge victory. But the same lineup, or at least similar lineup that we watched down the stretch last season, will be the one that we are watching in some form coming in to this season. And as opening day approaches, Jake, you sent out a tweet kind of hinting at this, but the notion that they are going to run this back to such a degree is kind of hard to fathom, but also sort of tracks with the rhetoric of the New York Yankees and the way that Aaron Boone talks about his players and the trust that they have in, of course, bouncing back from seasons. I think we talked about it on the pod at some point recently about Boone saying, you know, you'd be crazy to think Josh Donaldson won't bounce back and all these things. But how are we feeling with opening day now coming up later this month? About this Yankees lineup and what it will actually look like come opening day.
So there's what I feel, there's what Yankees feel, Yankees fans feel, and there's what, like, you know, the Yankees organization feels. The gap between what the fans want and what the organization wants right now, or what the organization is hoping for, is enormous. And it is a gap that we see on other teams. It's not just the Yankees, right? You have fans want the young, exciting new players, and not the players that they've seen struggle over the course of the year. Now, over the course of seasons, or, you know, in some of these guys' case, just last year. But it's important to remember that the new guys could just struggle like the old guys. And I think the shiny prospect is sometimes a mirage. In the Yankees' case, I think that those prospects deserve a chance to prove themselves. And I understand where Yankees fans are coming from. And I understand why they are banging their heads against the wall at the idea of Aaron Hicks in left field on opening day, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa at shortstop on opening day, and Josh Donaldson at third base on opening day. That trio, right? Kiner-Falefa, Donaldson, Hicks on literally like the whole left side of the baseball field. What Yankees fans want is LeMahieu at third, which would have Gleyber Torres at second. They want Oswald Peraza at short and Oswaldo Cabrera in left, right? One of those three things might happen on opening day, maybe. But what we're hearing and the way that Aaron Boone talks about his players, if I had to put money on it, I think that's the Yankees opening day lineup. And that's what they went with in that spring training game on Wednesday.
So you really think it'll be 3-for-3 of Donaldson, IKF, and Hicks. We also got word yesterday that Judge will indeed start playing some left field coming up in spring training games next week. Now, that hints at the possibility. Like, to me, Hicks is the one that I cannot fathom running back out there. And I know that he is still making a good chunk of money the way that Donaldson is, the way that LeMahieu is, and somehow LeMahieu is being the one relegated to a bench super utility role. But I think if I had to bet, I think Donaldson is a 1,000% will be starting at third base. That I have no doubt about whatsoever, barring injury. I still feel like Peraza has a chance to do it. Again, he's a guy who did play in AAA a little bit last year, unlike Volpe, and looked solid, certainly defensively, down the stretch last year. And either way, he's going to be hitting ninth. It's not like you're coming in and asking him to be, you know, batting at the top of the order. And I just feel like he is someone that can realistically earn this job in a way that doesn't feel like forcing it the way that it might be like handing Volpe the job. And so that's why Peraza, I still think, has a great shot. And in left field, like, I really do think that the Judge in left, stand in right, or stand in left, Judge in right. Like, I feel like that should be what they're doing. That way you can get LeMahieu back in the lineup. If you're so freaking desperate to put Hicks in there still and rotate him through, maybe you can. I just feel like that, or Cabrera too, right? We get him some playing time. I feel like that is not a crazy option. Like, I refuse to believe that Hicks. Okay, let's agree on Donaldson. We agree on Donaldson. Who's more likely to be starting on opening day, IKF or Hicks?
IKF.
I think I agree with you, but I still don't think it is a guaranteed certainty.
Now, the thing to talk about here is Oswaldo Cabrera freaking rules. He was a 2-win player last year in 44 games, mm-hmm. and over 162, he'd be like a 7-win player. Now, granted, small sample size and his defense graded out really, really well in left field, even though that's a position he's never played before, and his versatility gives him a lot of points there. But he's a really, really good player. He's, in my opinion, way better than Aaron Hicks right now. I think Hicks basically just gets Joey Gallo'd into nothingness by May.
Yeah. Obviously, they still have more of a financial commitment there than they did with Gallo. But yeah, no, I think that's a fair guess.
And the thing to remember, right, is the lineup on opening day, I'm betting that it's this, and that there's no Cabrera, no Peraza. Maybe you have Gleyber at second and LeMahieu DHing, or vice versa, okay? That doesn't mean that that's not going to be the lineup the next week, you know, or the next day. Like, just because it's the opening day lineup doesn't mean it's the lineup for the season. And I think that is definitely important to remember. Couple more things before we take a quick break, Jordan. Andrew Painter. You know, everyone knows how much I love Monet and Picasso, Rembrandt, Frida Kahlo, but Andrew is my favorite painter.
Wow. How many? I would like to know Andrew's favorite painter, to be honest. I know people have been making jokes about, oh, he's what a great perfect name. He's painting the corners. Let's really dig into this here. I mean, he's 19. I don't know what his art history background is. Obviously did not make it to college to take an intro to art history class like many of us did. But in his case, I would love to know. I would love that to be the next question that Alex Coffey asks him in spring training.
Well, you know, the Salvador Dali Museum is in Tampa, a short drive away from this Philly spring training.
Did not know that. Clearwater. All right.
Well, so someone should take Andrew Painter over to the art museum.
Very, very possible. So why are we actually talking about him? It's because he's 19 and legitimately competing for a starting job in the defending National League champion Philadelphia Phillies rotation. Now, we all knew he had one of the more dominant minor league seasons that we've seen in some time, let alone for someone who was just 19 last year in his first full pro season. But now it's like a real conversation. Now, of course, this is also a product of the Phillies having very little depth beyond their top four starters. And you know, normally guys are not... Yes, Andrew Painter is very talented and very good, but it's not exactly like he's beating out, you know, 10-year major league veterans at this point. He's basically competing with who? With Bailey Falter, with Christopher Sanchez, with Mark Appel? I don't know.
Michael Plassmeyer.
Yeah. Like, this is just not exactly a who's who of rotation depth. And so because of that, it's not like when you watch him, it's like, yeah, I mean, he looks like there's no way he can be any worse. Do you think this will actually happen? Do you think this is a good idea? And how stunning is this to kind of witness? Because we just have not had a lot of stories like this for pitchers, teenage pitchers, trying to make the team out of spring training.
So just a quick scan of Baseball Reference. We have had six teenage pitchers appear in the big leagues this century. Six. That's Elvis Luciano, who was with the Blue Jays in 19 and was terrible. Julio Urias in 16. Dylan Bundy came up at 19 before things went
at the very end,
terrible.
In September, I remember that. Yep.
In 12, Madison Bumgarner in 09, Felix Hernandez in 05, and Edwin Jackson in 03. It doesn't happen because, let's say you're a high school kid, you get drafted at 18, maybe 17, you're not good enough to pitch in the big leagues within a year. The gap between high school baseball and the big leagues is enormous. And so it usually takes at least 2 years. And by that time, you're 20.
That's the other thing is that was what was so amazing about Bundy. And he made it up in his first season. Like, which is just impossible to fathom, honestly. Like, it'd basically be like if Painter came up at the end of last year for the Phillies, which I don't think anybody was talking about it. And maybe I'm wrong. I don't think anybody was talking about that last year. But to your point, like the high school to the big leagues in 2 years is just so hard to fathom. A lot of those pitchers, you talk about Urias, talk about Felix, guys that had already been in pro ball since they were 16. I mean, Urias had been carving. I mean, he was already pitching when he was 16 as a professional. And so that's the advantage. And this is also true when you talk about position players too, right? There's a reason that the guys that are making it to the big leagues as teenagers have largely been international players, the Sotos, the Acuñas, the Vlads, whatever. And occasionally, you know, you have a Mike Trout, a Bryce Harper, but that it's, you have to be at such a ridiculous level to have climbed the minors that quickly and to be trusted that quickly. Now, again, like it's not hard to fathom that he is the fifth best starter on the Phillies right now. Like that part is not the craziest thing in the world. At the same time, like when you watch him and he's getting, who is it? I think it was Max Kepler, right? He gets Max Kepler to look really silly. And it's like, okay, like this is where the spring hype gets dangerous just because it's like, listen, you, and we just talked about this, it's the same thing we just said about the Yankees, but it's just like, these guys are not saviors always. And you just have to understand the risk that you're putting them in there. Is he the best option right now? Maybe. But you have to consider the big picture. But also Dave Dombrowski and the Phillies, like they are not ones to necessarily care too much about the big picture. And if he's their best option, he's their best option. So maybe he is going to break camp. I won't really believe it until I see it, but maybe.
I think if he doesn't break camp, he'll be up by the end of April. He is their best option. This team is not as good as it was in October. Their projected win total, I think, is somewhere around 86 or 87, 88, like high 80s. They're going to need every single win they can get, especially when you consider that Bryce Harper is out until the middle of the year. One of these other starters is going to get hurt and miss time, whether it's Walker, Nola, you know, Suarez or Wheeler. Like, someone's going to miss time, and that's going to push someone else up into that starting rotation. And I just think that Andrew Painter is going to make a significant amount of starts for the Phillies this year, whether he breaks camp or not, I think doesn't matter a whole lot. I would bet on him not breaking camp, but him being up pretty quickly and him being fine. I think he's going to be fine this year. He's not going to be dominant. He's going to show it in some spurts. Just go watch the highlights of Hunter Green last year, right? And that was after years and years of Hunter Green being in the minors. Mm-hmm. Coming up as a rookie pitcher is very hard to do. Spencer Strider was kind of a different situation because he had, I know he was injured a lot at Clemson, but he had played in college. He was a college pitcher who had competed, who had been used to that type of scenario, who was older. Like, he's an older guy. Painter is going to throw like 85 to 100 innings this year in the big leagues, maybe. And he's going to have like a 4.3, 4.7 ERA. And people are going to be, oh no. And then like in 2 years, he'll be an all-star.
Right.
You know?
And so, and listen, maybe, again, maybe he is a generational talent in a way that we thought Dylan Bundy was, right? To put it bluntly, I know he got hurt, but like, that's the thing. Like, you just, it can all look so good and so obvious. And then this is why it is just so scary with pitchers. But I generally agree with you. I think we'll see a good chunk of him this year. At the very least, I imagine he'll start in AAA. I mean, he only made 5 starts in AA last year, but considering where he's at right now, like, I imagine they would like him to be one stop away. But that's the other thing, right? I mean, it's possible he goes down to AAA and gets shelled in this first few starts, and then it doesn't feel like, it's just also delicate with these pitchers, but it's true for prospects in general, and it applies to the Yankees conversation. Like, it sounds great, man. It sounds great, and I hope we're all rooting for these kids when they come up, right? But Major League Baseball is really hard. And I hope that if they are going to throw them into the fire, that people understand that these things can be challenging at first.
Well, I mean, you even take a look at pitchers 20 and under who made starts in the big leagues. And there are 37 of them this century. Okay. And there are names like Clayton Kershaw, Madison Bumgarner, Jose Fernandez, mm-hmm. Matt Cain, Zach Greinke, guys who were and have continued to be elite starting pitchers. There's also, you know, Luis Gohara for the Braves, Jacob Turner for the Tigers, Henry Mejia for the Mets, right? Ryan Firebend for the Mariners. Like, there are players who turned into nothing because pitching is incredibly difficult. And we just need to remember that Andrew Painter is 19.
Yeah, but let's end this on a positive note. Wow, he looks the part in a way
so that is good.
Now, I will say there is part of me that is like, I do wonder when we will stop being stunned by velocity specifically. Like, I mean, not that it's not impressive, especially for a 19-year-old. And again, it's really about what he looks like and what the delivery looks like and the fact that he's that big and that coordinated and that smooth and it's coming out that well. But it is funny to me to some degree, people being like, oh my God, Painter's, you know, throwing 98. Like, yeah, that's pitching now. Like, if you're a first round pick, if you're a top pitching prospect, that's just what you're doing. That is what the pitchers look like now. But again, it's an age thing. He's really, really impressive.
Jordan, Andrew Painter is younger than Matty B. Raps.
What's Matty B up to, man? Do we know?
Couldn't tell you.
Is he still Matty still be rapping, or what do we have an update on that? All right, well,
I do not.
That's great though, right? Because for a while, it was like, oh my God, that guy's younger than Justin Bieber. And now we have to transition. We have to make an adjustment. And I appreciate you pivoting that to Matty B. Raps. All right, enough about Matty B. and Andy P. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back on Baseball Barbacast.
Andy Pettit?
Negro Leagues Baseball Museum President Bob Kendrick hosts the SiriusXM original podcast, Black Diamonds.
The Negro Leagues didn't care what color you were, and they didn't care what gender you were. Can you play?
Hear stories of the leagues and legends that shaped sport, culture, and society.
That's why the museum is so important. It's like, we are never going to forget you.
Episodes of the award-winning Black Diamonds are now available wherever you get your podcasts.
We're not talking about balls and strikes. We're talking about your life.
And we're back on a delightful episode of Baseball Barbacast. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. Thank you all for accompanying us on this podcast journey. And like every other podcast in the world, it's time to talk about the new rules. We're not going to dive too deep into it. We did a whole podcast about the new rules that you should go listen to if you haven't yet. Went very much in depth. But one of the takeaways from that podcast, Jordan, was that we couldn't predict everything, that there would be circumstances with the new rules that we would never anticipate that we would talk about once they happened. And here we are.
Yes. And we touched on this on the episode earlier this week about some of the early reactions to the pitch clock, specifically about just some situations that we hadn't even considered, like how much the catcher's position could influence when the hitter thinks they're ready. We had a situation where there was a dual violation and the count started 1-1 before anybody even started. Like, I hadn't thought about that as a possibility. So there's been all kinds of stuff like that. But today we wanted to talk a little bit more about the shift and the shift restrictions, because that is not something we touched on in last episode. And we don't have too much more to say about the pitch clock, at least for now. And so we wanted to spend a couple minutes talking about the shift restrictions. Now, Jake, admittedly, I've only just been watching spring training intently for the last couple days. Now, let's start there. Have you noticed, watching spring training games, have you felt like the shift restrictions that you can only have, you know, two batters or two fielders on each side of second base, no ifs, ands, or buts, like that's the rule, two guys on each side. Has that changed the way you've watched the game at all?
It hasn't changed my viewing experience, but I do think anecdotally more balls are getting through. Mm-hmm. I don't think that having two guys on either side of second base is actually playing that big of a role. What's playing a bigger role, in my opinion, is that everyone has to have their feet on the dirt. So in the past, right, you could put anybody anywhere. You could put your left fielder at third base. You could put your catcher on the moon. You know, you could do it anything you wanted. But now infielders have to have both heels on the infield dirt when the pitch is thrown. Now, if you go back and you take a look at shifts, a lot of those shifts, especially today when infielders' arms are so good, is guys were playing really far back to make sure balls didn't get through. And now that guys are playing further in, not necessarily over shifted, but in, that means that they're going to have less reaction time to field ground balls. And that, the idea that guys have to be in the dirt, is what shortstops have talked about. I think Correa talked about how he doesn't like that. Lindor talked about how he doesn't like that. That, to me, is a much bigger and more significant change than making sure there are two players on either side of the base.
I agree with that. And I think, too, that that gets more at what was suggested with this rule is not just about helping lefty pull hitters, you know, hit 235 instead of 225. It's more about how can we make the game more interesting? And yes, we want more balls in play in general, but we also, what was constantly hidden is we want our defenders to be making more interesting plays. And I will say that anecdotally so far, I have seen not necessarily more highlight plays, but more infielders needing to dive, more infielders ranging over for plays that they normally would be perfectly positioned to make. And that, to me, is more exciting. And yes, if Correa and Lindor don't like it, this is another case like, well, you're the best shortstops in the world. So I'm excited to see you figure it out.
They talked about how they like the new shift restrictions in terms of being on the other side of the base, but they don't love the idea that they can't play as far back as they want. And that's just because they're used to playing far back. And when you're a shortstop and you're like a kid, right? When you're in Little League and you play shortstop and you think you're hot shit, you play so far back because that's what the big leaguers did, right? Okay. And your coach is like, yo, come in. Like, you can't do that yet. You're not good enough to do that. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that that's kind of ingrained in their own sense of themselves as shortstops.
Yeah. Right? And I know part of it is also just like, these guys are hitting the ball 110. Like, I would like some more time and space to make these plays. But again, if it's making it more challenging for them like that, and we want to, you know, kind of almost force the athleticism to play a bigger role, then great. Like, I'm not saying I want guys getting injured because they're playing, you know, too close, but it's not like we're forcing them to stand on the infield, like in front of the dirt. So I like it. And I think that it is, to your point, that the main takeaway is I do think that that will make a bigger difference than just having two guys on each side of second base.
And you made this point, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago or whatever, that the teams that shifted the most in baseball, right, were the Astros and the Dodgers and these other really smart and successful teams. We had reached a point where front offices, the good front offices, were so skilled at shifting and knew where to put their players that we had reached a point of like boring, oh, the ball's hit right to this guy. I don't want to watch front office people be incredible at their jobs on TV. That's not entertaining. I want to watch Carlos Correa be incredible at his job. Sorry if you're working in a front office and you're listening, but that's just the truth.
But to that point, like, I am still curious to see within these restrictions how creative teams get. I don't feel like we've fully seen. I know people speculated about, oh, you know, maybe they will still pull the left fielder over to play in the short right field as a shift. But even more subtly in the infield, if there are certain positions that become more common, if certain shortstops decide, actually, I'm better off playing here or slightly different here now because I can't play on the grass, I'm curious to see what those look like and how that impacts. Of course, it's very early, but I agree with you. I think that is something that will make, hopefully, defense more interesting. And if it makes it more challenging, that's fine with me.
I have two pitch clock thoughts, Jordan. Mm-hmm. My first is intentional walks. Mm. Could I use the pitch clock to intentionally walk someone instead of saying four? Like, if I'm a pitcher and I just needed a breath and I was intentionally walking a guy, couldn't I just stand out there for 20 times four for a minute 20 and just four balls?
This is only semi-related, but we also got, I'm jumping ahead, but we got an email about the possibility of the opposite, which is an immaculate inning without throwing any pitches, which would, of course, require an extreme amount a extreme lack of discipline and focus from the hitter for that to take place. But to your point, I mean, sure, because what's interesting is that all of these rules, they punish you with balls and strikes, right? But as far as we know, it's not like you're getting fined by committing violations. You're not going to get suspended if you have a bunch of violations in the same game, because the idea is that is how you are being punished, right? That is how you're being punished. It's hurting you strategically, you know, in the actual game. So to your point, I mean, I guess you're saying that the advantage would just be like, I need a rest, and so I'm just going to stand on this mound for a minute and a half and walk this guy. I mean, I guess, although I don't know if that counts as skirting around the rule now, which is that you just are supposed to throw four fingers up and put them on first. Like, you have to declare that. I don't know.
No, you don't. Not in this situation. I'm going to pitch to this guy. Oh, whoopsie-doo. Time ran out. Like,
it's a fascinating question. I know that there's been parts of the rules with the shift where MLB's been like, if it seems like you are doing something to skirt around the rules, we will get on you for that. But this is an interesting case where I don't know how that quite fits.
Imagine runners on second and third, fourth inning, starters laboring, long inning, big slugger up, bad hitter behind him. I'm just going to, you know, get crisscross applesauce on the mound and just wait out for a minute 20.
Ball one. It's just, you're still sitting there. I'm not moving. Ball two. That's great. I really like this idea. It would take, again, like you said, a very specific situation to give it a try. But I like it. I think I would love to see someone try that.
Next question about the new pitch clock that came to mind. New balls. Mm, pitchers love getting a new ball.
This happened with Karinchak.
Correct. This happened with Karinchak, where he...
Yes.
Karinchak is why we have new rules. he's a big reason why, with all of his absurd fidgeting. But he asked for a new ball, and they gave him the new ball, and it counted as time. Right? Like it was not, the clock did not reset. Does getting a new ball then count as a disengagement?
Good question. Yeah, it seemed like in that situation, he asked for a new ball as like a Hail Mary to stop the clock, and it didn't work. And so I don't know. I'm sure that has to be in the rules somewhere. I'm not exactly sure about that. Does seem like a skirt around, but I imagine you probably can. In my opinion, that should be, you should, you know, stop the clock or reset the clock if you get a new ball. But I think also you are only obviously going to only get one new ball every at bat or every plate appearance or every whatever. And I know sometimes there are pitchers that will ask for multiple new balls in the same at bat, and you'll get umps that are very not amused by that. I'm sure that those days are done, but at the same time, I do think it probably should count as a disengagement or at least as a clock reset. But it was very funny to watch because, like, all this is another thing, which is a bigger, you know, takeaway from the pitch clock, is that there are certain things that when they look rushed do end up looking funny. And I understand players are uncomfortable. We had a funny moment with Correa yesterday where he took the first pitch and started wandering out of the box and, you know, start doing his thinking. And then he was like, oh shit, I got to get back in, and literally like jumped back in the box and like was looking really attentive. Like, those moments are funny, and that's what spring training is for. But yeah, I think that there are certain things that, again, we haven't thought of everything yet, and we're going to figure all those out in the coming weeks.
I want to talk about Max Scherzer and the pitch clock. So he had his first start earlier this week with the pitch clock. Couple takeaways. Number one, great example of if you're an adult and really good at baseball, you can use the pitch clock to your advantage. And he said this, I've said this before in the pod. He told me, he was like, I'm going to take advantage of this. You know, I'm going to game the shit out of this. And he did. He worked really, really fast and made hitters really uncomfortable. And then the hitters responded. Derek Hill got in the box really quickly, and Scherzer just waited him out for 9 seconds, just paused on the mound, and then struck him out with a fastball, right? And it is a reminder that the pitcher gets to dictate the pace. And we already knew this, and this is a feature of baseball for over a century. But with the pitch clock, I think it's even more obvious.
Yeah, and Scherzer literally said that in his post game. He was like, yeah, no, like, now I am entirely in control over this because the hitter has no choice but to step in and to decide, oh, he is ready or he isn't ready. And as we've seen, there are some issues with that, you know, involving the catcher and how ready the catcher is. But yeah, I think if you want to take this head on and you trust your catcher, or if you're like Max Scherzer and you know exactly what you want to throw all the time, you're in good shape. And I do think that the early, of course, we talked about this with Ryan LaVarnway, but like, I would say that the early takeaways and as far as how the players have talked about it is that the hitters are more uncomfortable than the pitchers. And that is a very interesting outcome. And if that ends up being true, then it's funny because that is kind of not what baseball wants. Baseball, in a lot of ways, so much of it is about how can we help the hitters more? And instead we might, again, it's way too early to decide this. And most hitters are going to be fine. But if it ends up hurting the hitters more than pitchers, I think that is one of the funnier outcomes of this whole situation and just classic thing to happen to Major League Baseball, honestly.
I do love Scherzer calling his own pitches with the pitchcom on the mound. We're going to learn pretty quickly which pitchers are going to call their own games and which pitchers won't. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be much more obvious and apparent who's boot bopping on their wrist on the mound and who's just, you know, going and throwing.
Right. But also the other one we heard from this week was Alex Cobb was saying like, this didn't feel like baseball, was really rushed. And he wasn't saying like, this is the worst thing ever, it shouldn't have it. He was like, yes, I understand why we have it, it's good. But his point was like, in spring training right now, I am entirely focused on making sure my delivery is in sync. And I was not able to think about that at all. And so I know Alex Cobb maybe has a slightly weirder delivery than most. And so maybe that hurts him more than others. And we've seen, you know, the likes of Luis Garcia having to adjust the thing. I go back to what you said when we all started. You guys are the best in the world. Figure it out. You will figure it out. It's fine. But I did have at least some sympathy to the point where it's just like the upside of doing it in spring training is the games don't count. The downside is that is also when you're working on things, and they, in this case, do not literally have time to work on things in some senses.
Well, just go work on things on a backfield.
Right.
That's the thing.
He admitted, and I think Hunter Brown said this too. He had a really bad first spring start. He was like, yeah, we have it on the backfields, but no one's enforcing it. And that's the thing. Like the guys, they're going to have to self-police on these backfield games. And I imagine that the teams that were doing it more, I saw we both had kind of conflicting experiences seeing practices on the backfields and how much it was being enforced. I barely saw it enforced anywhere that I went. You said you did see it being enforced on the backfields. And that's exactly how you're going to get ready. Because if you are going on the spring training game and actually experiencing it for the first time versus, you know, having your coach yell at you a couple times in the past week, yeah, it's probably a lot harder.
Last thing to talk about before we take a break, Jordan, no ump, no problem. This is already, I think, one of the most responded to tweets we've ever had, which is hilarious. So why don't you walk everyone through what happened?
Let me set the scene because I think that is part. There's a couple conversations that we had here. All right. How does this happen? So it turned out that I was possibly the only person left watching Pirates, the end of the Pirates Orioles spring training game yesterday. Now, the reason, or 2 days ago, yesterday? I don't know. Anyway, the reason that this is so, 2 days ago, the reason why this is so funny and why it was so perfect to be not paid attention to is because it was, you know, in spring training, you have the 1 o'clock wave of games and then you have the 3 o'clock wave of games. And what results is because, you know, you have the Arizona game starting. And I think what happened is that oftentimes the ends of the Florida spring training games are completely ignored because obviously most of the players are out and no one is watching these, and particularly Pirates Orioles. And so the 3 o'clock games had already started and there was other stuff to watch. And so I don't think anyone was watching this, but I was still watching it for some reason. Jackson Holliday came in the game and I was like, all right, cool, I'll watch this. So I'm watching, it's the Pirates broadcast. We know the Orioles aren't broadcasting any games. It's the Pirates broadcast. And the game ends and I just have it on. Whenever I was working on something and I just, it just stayed on and the broadcast continues and I'm very confused and I see the umpires walking away, but the broadcast is still on and I see Brandon Hyde and Derek Shelton having a conversation and the broadcast is still on. At this point, I still have it on mute and I have Twitter open and I see all the Pirates and Orioles writers tweeting out like, all right, you know, Pirates win 7-4. And I'm looking at this like, am I crazy? Like, it looks like they're still playing the game. Like, am I missing something? And I saw Justice De Los Santos posted about this in his video. He said, he said literally he saw the last out and he went up and walked back to the media room and didn't think. And then by the time he got back, he was like, well, what do you mean? They're still playing? What's going on? What happened was, this does happen. This is not the first time we've ever seen this happen. Because, again, the point of spring training is to get your work in, and pitchers are scheduled to throw. And so if they don't get to throw, you want them to throw. The Orioles wanted, I believe it was Ofrede Gomez, to get an inning against the Pirates in the bottom of the ninth, despite the game being, yes, over by the rules of baseball. And so Derek Shelton said, sure, no problem. Mason Martin, go get an AB. Drew Maggi, go get an AB, no problem. Let's just keep playing baseball. And so what we had was an umpireless inning. Why the umpires had such an issue with sticking around, I don't know. I mean, I feel like everyone's saying, yeah, well, their job is to umpire an official baseball game, and they did that. They completed that duty, and they left. But the ultimate result of this is the fact that this was still broadcasted, and this was a very funny thing to witness. It is nothing now, more than that.
Technically, if we're being technical, okay, the Pirates and Orioles played 8.5 innings of baseball, and then the game ended, and then they scrimmaged for a half inning.
Yes.
That is what it says. Officially, Ofrede Gomez's half inning of work is not on the box score.
Yes. He does not get credit for that, right? And so when I tweeted this and I said, like, wow, like the umpires left and they're still playing, and I phrased it thinking the game was over. Yes, I understand the game was over. But to me, it brought in this whole existential question of what is a game? When is a game over? What is spring training? What is the point of any of this? What counts? What doesn't count? And Joe Block, the Pirates broadcaster, and Neil Walker, they had a lot of fun with this, and that was part of the fun of this too. But I think that the fact that it was continued to be broadcast is a huge part of this. The Pirates broadcast could have cut off. They said, Pirates win 7-4. We'll see you tomorrow. We'll see you. And then none of us, like, you would have gotten a few tweets of people being like, hey, they're still playing. This is weird. But like, it would not have been the same thing.
Ofrede is going to throw an extra inning. Like, it's just nothing tweet. No, but instead, the fact that they broadcasted it made it feel like a real game, except for the very obvious fact that there was no umpire behind the catcher, which was, it felt very bare. and naked. Yes. It was very bizarre.
Because again, this happens on backfields all the time where you have inner squads or you have, you know, live BP where you have someone's calling balls and strikes from behind a net, or you have the catcher calling balls and strikes, which was the case in this game with Maverick Hanley. And you could see Brandon Hyde. So you're like, hey, Mav, just call balls and strikes. And Maverick's like, all right, sure. I guess. All right. Well, I guess I'll do that. Now he only had one close call, and I'm glad he gave it to his pitcher, which was great. The thing is that, and everyone making the jokes, oh my God, see, you can play baseball without umpires. I just wish we had one more close play during this inning to see what would have happened. Because again, not that it would have mattered, not that people would have gotten actually angry, but like, I do wonder what would have happened if there was any sort of discourse of a bang bang play at first, or like a hard slide, or like a like something like that, where you actually had to, someone actually had to make a call. That would have been interesting. That was not the case. And so we didn't actually see a challenge.
Right. Because the discourse afterwards was no one's calling balls and strikes, but FYI, umpires do a lot of other stuff too. And none of that came into play, right? There were no fair foul calls, or there were no reviews. There was
right. The pitch clock was off. The pitch clock was off, right? So right. Freddy Gomez could have, I mean, he really could have taken his sweet time if he wanted there. But one of a really small part of it that I think went, that I just laughed at so much, that first at bat against Mason Martin, he fouled off a bunch of balls. And normally, what does a catcher do? Oh, hey, just ask for a new one from the ump behind him. But he did that the first time, and he's like, oh, there's no one here. And he had to like look in the dugout and have them throw him a new ball. So that happened like five times, which was hilarious. But yeah, I mean, again, this is not like there were people. But what happened, again, let's get to the more meta conversation about this, which is the fact that because I happen to be the only person to tweet this, at least first, you know, this tweet has, I don't know, 24,000 likes and the 2 million views or whatever, and SportsCenter is posting it and being like, oh my God, the umps left before the game ended. It's like, well, no, but like that's, but it's like, you don't want to, and then the people getting mad and being like, wow, you dumbasses don't understand baseball, which to me, of course, my response is to anything like this is just like, who fucking cares? This is just a funny thing that happened. It's all going to be okay. It's all going to be okay.
Well, you were like, you said something that was like, to me earlier along the lines of, yeah, people got really mad about this. And I was like, well, I think people get really mad about anything SportsCenter level of tweet, right? Anything that gets to that many people, people will be mad.
Right. So it was just so goofy. But yeah, that's all it was. And that's all it had to be. There's nothing more than that. Although I will say, Brandon Hyde had a funny quote after the game. This just made me laugh because it just imagining the interaction was just very funny. Kind of explaining like, okay, because normally, you know, you can have a dialogue with the, you know, you can agree with the league and be like, no, like we're going to play an extra inning and the umpire will do that. and so I think this is from Nathan Ruiz, where he's talking about what Brandon Hyde said after the game. And he said, Orioles manager Brandon Hyde said, quote, we were told by the league we could play it by the umpires and pitch the bottom half of the ninth. And I guess Chad Fairchild felt like we couldn't. It's just like, it's just so funny. So I love that. Anyway, that's the umpireless game. Maybe we'll see it again someday. Maybe not.
Let's take a quick break and we will be back to wrap up a lengthy but delightful edition of Baseball Barbercast. And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. Just this episode, not the whole show. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And we have an email to talk about and a notable, bizarre baseball happening that not a whole lot of people outside of Minnesota know about. And that's where we will begin. Jordan, tell me about the Minnesota Baseball Jamboree.
Yes. So U.S. Bank Stadium, which I believe is where the Vikings of Minnesota play football during the National Football League season. It is also the home to college baseball during this time of year because it is not particularly pleasant to play baseball outside in Minnesota. And so schools ranging from the University of Minnesota all the way down to like Division II junior colleges that you've never heard of, all are welcome at U.S. Bank Stadium during the month of March to play in baseball games in a very goofy configuration, which I highly recommend you Googling and seeing what a baseball field in a football stadium looks like. Now, all that said, the beauty of this event, and it is not one event, there are multiple tournaments throughout the month of March where this happens, is that there are so many teams that want to play games, and they are so accommodating that essentially they are playing 24/7 during the month of March. And if that sounds insane, understand that this began yesterday on March 1st with two Division III schools, Crown College and Hamline University. Hamline, are they a university? Hamline University. All right. Congrats to them. Hamline University in St. Paul. They started a doubleheader at 5:30 a.m. local time. That was the first game of the year for both teams.
Rise and shine, baby.
The first of three doubleheaders being played yesterday, I believe. The last one beginning at 9:30 and playing deep into the night, well past midnight. We've heard stories of games starting at 1, 2 a.m. because you're inside. The lights are on. Who cares? Like, we're warm and we're playing baseball in March in Minnesota, and that is all that matters. The time is irrelevant. And it is just a truly ridiculous and goofy thing. And I just wanted to ask you, Jake, I know I believe you played games in college at 8. Did you have 8 a.m. starts or 9 was the earliest you started?
I had an 8 a.m. start, yes.
You had an 8 a.m. start in Florida? So correct. Florida, same kind of thing where there's a lot of college baseball tournaments in Florida. Well, they start at 8 because they're trying to squeeze in 4 games a day on a single field. And there's so many teams down there. But 5:30 is okay. Here's a question. Did they sleep, right? When did they get to the field? How do you prepare to start a baseball game at 5:30? Did they take batting practice?
Well, so that's the thing. There's a number of conflicting, incongruent factors at play.
Let me also say, we can find out the answers to this since we know the Crown head coach, and I will try to get some answers for the next podcast. But go ahead.
So for the first game of the year, or for the first game of a day in college, you typically will show up about 2.5 hours before first pitch. And you'll take BP, and you'll do infield, outfield, and you'll throw, and you'll hang around. And, you know, a lot of nothing happens, but you get there early, right? So that would mean they would have gotten there at 3 a.m. I do not believe that they got there at 3 a.m. I don't think that's true. My guess would be that they got to the field at 4:30 a.m. and they hit in a cage somewhere and they took infield, outfield at some point and they threw and they got loose. You need an hour to really prepare for a game. You need an hour. And so I would imagine they got there at 4:30. I would imagine they left wherever they were leaving at 4. And I would imagine their wake-up call in the hotel was like 3:15. And I cannot imagine that everyone felt rested.
Well, I think the good news for these teams is I believe they are coming from home. I know some of the other teams are coming in from a little bit farther, whether it is in Minnesota or out of state. I know that Vanderbilt and Maryland and Nebraska are going up to play in a tournament there this weekend, although they wouldn't start Vanderbilt before 10 a.m. Don't you worry. But Crown College, the idea of telling Tim Corbin that he's going to start that first pitch is 5:30 a.m. is just so amazing. But it's like, oh, we can make South Dakota Technical Junior College play a game starting at 2 a.m.? Like, sure, no problem.
I love the idea of having a cup of coffee, playing a doubleheader, and then taking your morning shit in that order.
Oh my God. It's just it's amazing. So anyway, we love this. And we've heard from people. I tweeted about it yesterday. We had people in the mentions talking about experiences in this tournament. It's just absolutely bizarre. I know they used to do this in the Metrodome too, unsurprisingly, but it is just, on top of the fact that the field is one of the goofier looking fields you'll ever see, it just makes the whole experience so weird, and weird enough that we had to talk about it on this podcast and not just our college baseball podcast.
And Minnesota University of Minnesota? University of Minnesota plays about a dozen or so games, home games in the dome. They don't play outside until April because Minnesota is COLD. And so this is their second home stadium, which is hilarious. If you think about it, Minnesota baseball plays more games in U.S. Bank per year than the Vikings.
Yes, which it's their home field. They should get a priority of it all year round. I think that's a fair assessment.
Let's move to the emails, Jordan. Where would you like to begin?
Okay, we have a lot of really good emails, but I think we should save some for next week. Next week, we got the WBC starting, so you can send some WBC emails. But I think next week, we'll do WBC preview and hit a bunch more emails. So let's just stick with this one that we got from Olivia yesterday, and the one that we prepared for the most. So Jake, why don't you go ahead and read this one from Olivia?
This is from Olivia. She says, "Hey, Jake and Jordan. Love this week's pod. Quick note, though. Molly May and Tommy Fury are not married, just dating as far as the public knows. That's my fault. I apologize, everybody."
You misled me.
Since we're on the topic of dating shows, I like how Olivia's like, "Speaking of the thing I was just speaking about, I was wondering which baseball player you think would be the most likely to go on a dating show like Love Island or The Bachelor, and which player would create the most drama as a contestant. Go Terps. P.S. Hope to see you guys in a Maryland game this season." Well, I was there 2 days ago. Olivia, this is a phenomenal question. We absolutely love it. And there are examples of athletes going on these dating shows before. There was a Travis Kelce finding love. I think it was called Catching Kelce dating show. And we've had very, I think, like, wasn't one of the Bachelor guys a former NFL player too? And
yeah. Well, he is literally the host of the Bachelor now, is Jesse Palmer, who was a big college football guy, and yeah, now he's doing it. But I think this is also important, is that we got kind of two different questions here, because I'm more familiar with The Bachelor. Jake is much more familiar with Love Island. But they're two very different shows, and the kinds of people that it attracts is also very different. And if we're talking about the player as The Bachelor versus the player as a contestant on The Bachelorette or on Love Island, those are two very different assignments. And so we tried to consider that when answering your question.
So the other thing we took into account is this person single? Very difficult to know. Obviously, we're not trying to pry too deep into anybody's private life, but there are some players who are like definitely married, right? Like they're 100% married.
Many of your favorite players are extremely married or extremely in a relationship, and you know about it because you follow them on Instagram. It's not complicated. So we tried to keep it to the players that are publicly single as far as we know. Which, is that problematic? Of course. But you know what? We're going to have fun with this question.
It's basically who's not posting on Insta. You know what I mean?
Right. So if we're going to name anybody who is already in a committed relationship, we apologize. We are doing this strictly on personality and vibes. And also, have you posted your significant other on Instagram?
Yeah, we're not trying to end your relationship. But if we do, that's on us. The number one pick in this, and it's really not close, the more I thought about it, is Harrison Bader of the New York Yankees, who is like very single, I believe, and dresses like a very famous person and is attractive and on the Yankees.
I mean, it tracks with what we just, the whole reason we're having this conversation is that he looks like a Paul brother. So, I mean, which is a good place to start. And the fact that he's now on the Yankees, of course, you know, his hometown team, like he just checks a lot of boxes. The way that he dresses, the way that he talks, the way that it's perfect. It's perfect. That is an absolute layup. Harrison Bader would fit well on any of these shows.
And I mean, you could name the show something, you know, like running them down or.
Oh, you mean if he's like the star and he's like in the, but yes.
Yeah. Going yes. Yard with Harrison Bader, you know.
Yes, like, all kinds of options. But that is definitely the first one that came to mind.
Making contact.
That's kind of an issue for Harrison Bader though. So I'm not sure if maybe that would be what we're promoting. We're trying to, you know, help in more than one sense.
Yeah. I think Bader is the best pick. Great by pick. A mile.
Great.
But Giancarlo Stanton, who might be standing next to him for a lot of the season, he came to mind as well. Mm-hmm. Kind of more obvious and definitely like a lower key interactor, but definitely as more famous. And like, look at Stanton. Like, look at the guy.
Yeah, it's not complicated. Not complicated. That's a good one. I think, he's really the lay. I mean, he would be the... probably the first one you most people would name. But so those two. And then the other one I think that stands out is Bo Bichette. as far as someone who looks like they should just be on television, I feel like he certainly fits. Now, he's not as much of an outgoing personality, I would say, but he certainly has the coolness factor and someone that you would like to just watch exist, right? We kind of talk about that with like Tatis. Tatis would maybe be another option for this, although maybe a little chaotic, but I think he would.
He's a sneaky perfect.
Yeah, I think Tatis is another good one. If you want to go like a more cleaner cut, but maybe not that interesting, but like obvious heartthrob is Jeremy Peña. He certainly played that role in the postseason last year. I think he would fit in this very much as well. Who are some other guys that stand out here?
Christian Yelich came to mind, though I'm sure some people would want Christian Yelich's mom to have her own dating show.
Well, I thought you were going to just be like, Pete Davidson's certainly making the rounds. I mean,
that's a great point. It's just like B-team Pete Davidson is Christian Yelich, and so Christian Yelich is just dating all the people that Pete Davidson dated after Pete Davidson dated them.
Then you could go like more the mystery man route. You know, Joey Votto is someone that certainly would be interesting under literally any context of any situation, any dating show, anything. So I think that's an easy one. Here's one. I have no idea his relationship status, so this could be totally unfair. Matt Chapman, he kind of fits in the along the Jeremy Peña. I know people think he looks like Josh Hutcherson. That maybe helps. He could definitely fit in the Bachelor category.
Sandy Alcantara is super good looking and tall and now a Cy Young winner and is in Miami, which I think would be a great place for the show to be. He definitely fits. And I believe he's single enough that there was no significant other sitting next to him when he accepted his Cy Young award that was spelled wrong on the MLB Network.
Which is, I guess, some kind of hint. So again, we are doing way too much digging into people's first alive chances. But listen, it's a great question. Do you have any last ones?
Well, another obvious one is Julio Rodriguez, who, if he was single, would I think be my first pick for this. He would be. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, again, it's 80 charisma and I mean, everything.
Adley, too, actually.
Oh, yeah. Adley. Adley's a really good. Exactly. Yeah. Don't try and break up Julio from his superstar athlete girlfriend. I mean, come on now. Let's leave them alone. Let's let the young love flourish. But Adley's a good one. Adley's one a little more more realistic.
I do want to talk about Julio's current relationship. I don't know how much people know about this. It's kind of nuts.
Well, again, it's so everybody knows about Dansby Swanson and Mal Pugh, and they just got married and they've been together for several years. And of all people, Bob Nightingale actually just wrote about this. He just wrote about Dansby and Mal Pugh, but also Julio and Jordan. I believe it is Huitema. I believe Huitema is the pronunciation, who is on the Canadian national team, women's national team for soccer. And she also plays, I believe, professionally in Seattle, which is pretty cool. And yeah, they've been together for a few months. And it is just like a younger version of like, holy shit, these two really successful, attractive people found each other. Amazing. what a concept.
Well, and, you know, I believe Jordan Huitema was dating Alphonso Davies, who's the best male Canadian soccer player in the world, for like 4 years. You know, and now she's with Julio.
Well, let me tell you, there are some very angry soccer fans who have never heard of Julio Rodriguez in the Instagram comments. I'll just leave it at that. One of them is one of the best players in their sport and has $300 million coming his way, and the other one doesn't. So you know what? It's okay. They're all going to be just fine. I wish Alphonso Davies the best.
So yeah, let us know who we missed. Jose Ramirez is another one.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting one. Okay. I would love that, man. Anything too, like it's just a different conversation. Do you want someone to be starring drama? Do you want someone to just be like the boring hot guy? There are a lot of options in baseball, but we did our best. So Olivia, let us know. I'm sure you've clearly thought about this question, so maybe you have some good answers as well. Would love to hear the not male perspective of this. Would also be good to know how off base we are of this. So please let us know. But yeah, that was a good email. You can any final thoughts?
Oh,
yeah.
Rob Manfred?
Rob Manfred? No, but pretty sure he's married. But that's certainly would be interesting. I'm sure people would certainly tune in for that.
There's no quicker way for him to change people's perception of him than that.
Wow. What a weird note to end on. Well, you can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast@gmail.com. Again, a lot of good emails recently. Hopefully we'll get to them soon. We appreciate you all listening. Thank you, Jake, for hosting this podcast with me. Thank you to Chris Tyler for producing it. Hopefully when we return next week, we will not have any more extremely depressing injuries to discuss. But until then, we hope you enjoy the weekend and we will talk to you very soon. Jake, finish the podcast.
Don't drop a kettlebell on your toe.
Sirius XM Podcasts.